Hey, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jeff Ponce, Mark Chiarelli on the Baseball America Prospect Podcast. Mark's making the rounds this week. It's like we've brought him into ESPN to Bristol, and he's doing the car wash. He was on Hot Sheet Show and now the Prospect Podcast.
It's like once a year I come out from behind Slack and do a couple of these and then scurry back into my hole until the offseason.
You go away for vacation, and what do? As soon as you're back, it's like, hey, you got to be on all these, you know. So, but welcome. We are glad that you are here today. We are talking prospects as we always do, but today got an interesting topic, I think. We're going to talk about risk in prospects because there's especially hitters risk. We'll talk a little bit about pitchers. Mark's here to talk. He's going to give us a deep dive about Bubba Chandler. So if you're a Pirates fan or a prospect fan, stick around for that. But we wanted to talk today about risk. And one of the reasons we're doing that is we're talking about it because we are in the process of prepping for the 2026 prospect handbook, for the 2026 offseason, 25/26, but into the 26 season, top 10 and top 30 prospect rankings. And we have the BA grades with that. So we have a grade, which is our projected potential role for a player down the road in the big leagues, and then a risk factor for that. And we're doing a little bit of audit of that. We're doing a little bit of a look at it and say, maybe are there better ways that we can do this, tweaks we can make? But that led us to kind of talking about this and kind of led to a topic, which I think is a good one for this. Jeff, will kind of put you on the spot first on this, because we were talking about safe prospects. Like, okay, and again, they're prospects. When you say safe, Aaron Judge is an 80 safe, because if Aaron Judge retired tomorrow, he has already put on his resume that he is one of the best players in baseball. Shohei Ohtani is an 80 safe. When we're talking about, because he's a top of the of baseball player who's already done it. When we're talking about prospects, obviously even safe, even low risk, still involves risk because they're climbing the ladder. They're going to face tougher competition. But as we kind of start with this, Jeff, I do feel like we have some guys at the top of our list this year who fit that category of, as prospects go, relatively safe prospects, low risk prospects, as far as their probability of being very productive big leaguers. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think, you know, right now there's a really exciting group at the top. We talked about it a lot. And I feel as if, you know, over the last few months, a lot of those guys that were ranked that highly that do have these big tools have performed. The underlying data backs it up. The feedback backs it up. You know, historically, we've done pretty well, I think, at the top of the list generally. But I do have a really high level of confidence within that player group. But there just isn't a lot of risk at this point in time with those guys.
So, okay, Mark, I'll kind of put it this way. Kevin McGonigal, like Connor Griffin's our number one prospect, and he's a relatively low-risk prospect, I would say, but just reached double A, you know, was a year ago, was thought to have questions about the hit tool, even though he's got a chance to finish, you know, among the leader, the minor league leaders in batting average this year, with power and speed and all that. But Kevin McGonigal, I struggle to come up with a whole lot of hitters who check more boxes from a standpoint of, like, there are guys who could be better than him is the way I would put it. But the Tiger shortstop prospect, it's hard for me to come up with the, oh, this is the potentially wounding, I wouldn't even say fatal flaw, but wounding flaw that is going to keep this player from being a productive big leaguer. How do you see it?
Yeah, it's a fascinating. And the more that I thought about it too, they're like the inverse of each other, where I still have, I'm interested to see with Griffin once he gets to double A. I think we've talked to some folks who still have some minor concerns, maybe about how the swing looks aesthetically. I think anytime someone makes such a rapid improvement with the hit tool over the course of 1 year, naturally, I'm very curious to see what it looks like in year two, what happens in spring training 2026. But his supplemental tools, everything around the hit tool is just so loud and so intriguing that for me, that really lowers the risk, to your point. I think with McGonigal, the thing that's really jumped out to me and has changed my perception of him, there's some authority with how the contact that he's making this year, even relative to some of the players of his age or even a little bit older who are now behind him on the list. I think for me, that's what really jumps out. And as you started to, you posed the question, he's maybe the safest prospect since who? Since blank. I wanted to ask both of you how you assess safety relative to ceiling. Because when I hear that question, or I think even maybe when BA readers hear that question, like inherently I think safe, but lower ceiling. And I don't think that's necessarily what we're talking about with McGonagall, but maybe I'm wrong. But how do you guys kind of parse through, you know, that juxtaposition as you assess guys like this at the top?
You start us off, Jeff.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I'm looking at, particularly with hitters, I think, you know, number one, it kind of starts with tools. You know, are there tools here? Is there some level of athleticism? Is there a baseline defensive sort of floor? And that may not be that this guy sticks at shortstop or he sticks in center field or even sticks at catcher long term. You know, catchers, that's a little bit more tricky, but we don't see a ton of those guys super high up either. But, you know, I typically have a high level of confidence that, like, at worst, they're going to end up at second base or third base or a corner outfield position. I think we've seen that. The Padres, you know, starting lineup at points in the 2024 season were kind of the perfect example of that, the culmination of how guys up the middle, in terms of when they come into pro ball, can move off of positions and still be really valuable defensively other areas. So you start with that. Certainly having some ability to run helps. I just think, like, those baseline of, like, average to fringe average skills around the tools. And then we start to look at the hit tool, which is honestly the most important part of it. The bat to ball ability, is it at a certain level? And I think that these are all sliding scales when it comes to kind of the big three. And teams talk about it and look at it like this. They may have another component that's factored in too, but there's typically something they're looking at from a bat to ball perspective, whether it's an analyst or whether it's a scout at a game, writing up a scouting report or turning in his report. He probably has some sort of broken down, like, contact or bat to ball grade, approach grades in terms of what the swing decisions are like. And, you know, there's a wide spectrum of what can be considered good swing decisions. And some of that has to do with what your hit tool and bat to ball ability is like, and then what your raw power is like, which is sort of that third component. I think teams are also factoring in now, and I know in a lot of my analysis, when I break down data and try to do more of the analytics side of things, I'm looking at batted ball angles and ball flight. And I think this is something that people have been doing as analysts, maybe even on their own, when they're looking at FanGraphs pages and checking the line drive rate of a guy and a ground ball rate of a guy and a fly ball rate of a guy. And a lot of this stuff is just, like, more dialed in, more honed in versions of those. That are going to the specific parts of the skills that can potentially scale. So when I see somebody checking a few of those boxes, whether it's, you know, power and approach or contact and approach or contact and power, there's usually sort of a profile that fits in. When someone checks all three boxes, I'm very confident that those skills are going to scale up to the major leagues, because the contact might go down a little bit. The power stays the same. And I know JJ has some research he's done recently that can back that up. And then the approach will probably back up a little bit, but I think you sort of need to have enough leeway, enough slack in those numbers to be able to take a little bit of a dip and still be productive and still not get, you know, sort of eaten alive. And I think for the most part, when we look at this underlying data and we look at those other tools and how they support everything, that gives us a pretty high degree of confidence that, you know, that's going to scale. Now, that's definitely changed from the times before we had access to advanced data, you know, through sourcing, et cetera, which is probably about 4 or 5 years ago. There, you know, you kind of had to reverse engineer some of this stuff and maybe didn't even think about it conceptually. But I think we're just way more dialed in and, you know, very specific in terms of how we break down skills now than what we were even years ago.
I would agree with a lot of that. And what I would say is that, yeah, we used to reverse engineer a lot of it, right? Like, now we have the ability to get the first level of it rather than the second level, which is, okay, before you would look at batting average, you would look at on base, you would look at walk percentage, strikeout percentage, power, you know, isolated power. And those were kind of in the dark ages when I started at BA, and, you know, you literally, these games, you couldn't even see the players, right? Like, you would talk to people about the players. But if there was a player playing on the West Coast, a player who went through the Cal League and then went through, you know, the Texas League and then went through you know, the Northwest League before that, you know, ended up in the PCL. If I'm based in North Carolina, chances that I would actually see that player in person, unless I saw him at the Futures game or something, was pretty much that. And back when they didn't really have MILB TV or anything like that. So you would talk to people about players, but then you would, a lot of it would be using these more rudimentary stats to try to interpret it. And then you would have to put it through the filter of, yeah, his power numbers look great, but he was doing that at Salt Lake City, and Salt Lake City power numbers are very different than the IL and all that. Now, I think it is a lot simpler, where you can say, does a hitter make good swing decisions, right? Does he know strikes versus balls, what to hit, what to let go? Does the hitter have bat control to make contact when he makes those decisions? And again, those are some of the things that you still can reverse engineer some if you don't have the data. Like, if you look at swinging strike percentage, if you look at, just even strikeout percentage, there's a lot of analogs there. But those decisions. And then, do you have the ability to make impact? If you have those three things, those are, to me, kind of the cornerstones of a hitter. And especially then we're talking about risk, to kind of what Jeff said. If you're talking about someone who plays up the middle, even if they're not the toolsiest player in the world, Kevin McGonigal, I don't think, is the toolsiest player in the world. You can debate whether he's going to be a shortstop or he's going to be a second baseman, you know, long-term or whatever. More inclination, he could probably stay at short, but he might be better to have, you might have someone better. Arm's probably going to limit him a little bit, all these kind of things. But he's going to be playing an impactful defensive position. He's not a first baseman who can barely play first base. When you have those kind of things, that's what makes you feel really good about it. But to kind of kick it back to you, Jeff, Jesus Mate, who's number three on our list now, we talk about a lot on this show, I feel like. But what made us comfortable last year, I would say, really pushing him up? We were getting a lot of positive scout feedback, but on top of that, when it came to swing decisions, that's usually the last, like, the tool that often for younger hitters is the kind of the big question mark. You were seeing from him exceptional swing decisions, weren't you, that kind of made us feel comfortable that the power and the bat to ball and all are good, but it's the swing decisions that are really kind of where his separator, where you could feel more comfortable about him than the normal elite DSL prospect.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, it's always a combination of things too. It's not just swing decisions. There's guys, you know, that maybe get on the top 30s because of that, but certainly, you know, not high up, you know, the top 100. It was those swing decisions, and it was that balance of really never expanding the zone down there, which is a great trait to have in the DSL, because they give you plenty of chances to swing outside the zone. A higher heart swing rate and a zone swing rate, which is indicative, you know, at least analytically, obviously, you know, you want to watch these players and get a better feel for it. But in the big sample, that tells me that this player is not expanding the zone, but when he does see a pitch over the heart of the plate, which is a very hittable pitch, regardless of what your swing type is like, what your bat path is like, what type of hitter you are, you know, swinging over and making contact with pitches over the plate is obviously important. So he had that higher rate, and then he factored in the power. And I think that's still the thing that you see, even in comparison to Peña, who's had a very good season. The bat to ball skills for those guys are very similar, but then you look at the power for Mate, it's, you know, another delineation up. And then it's, you know, when it comes to the swing decisions, it might be two or three. Mate is just he has this sort of balance of aggression and patience that's just very rare in young players and in young, exciting kind of irreverent players too. Like, he's, you know, like, he's a big personality. Like, you know, when he's on the field, you know, when he's up at bat, he almost kind of Soto shuffles with some of his takes. There's a lot of confidence there at the plate. The biggest thing for him is just kind of, you know, figuring out and optimizing those angles, but, you know, really big power, very rarely chases. And it's not like he's overly passive. He's not, you know, like a 35% swing rate guy or somebody like that who, you know, almost doesn't swing and kind of juiced his walk numbers to a fault. That's really not the type of player that Mate is. And I think, you know, that's what gives us such a high level of confidence in him being pretty productive.
So, okay, to kind of summarize this, I kind of want to pose the question out there. Okay, we talked about McGonagall. Who else to you, to both of y'all, putting both of you on the spot, and then I'll answer too. But who stands out as, when we talk about hitters, is to you an exceptionally low-risk hitter who's in our top 100? And we'll answer that right after this quick break.
FT fam, when you're playing in games, you kind of have some stress, anxiety. Teammates need somebody, something to help. Now it's at your fingertips with Rula.
That's right. Telehealth has been a huge help for millions of people, but it can be time-consuming and expensive to find the right therapist. Rula is on a mission to make this process smoother. And make sure you go to rula.com/val for more details. They take most major insurance plans, and the average copay is only about $15 per session. Every provider on Rula is carefully vetted and chosen for their expertise. Thousands have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. Head on over to rula.com/val to get started today. After you sign up, they ask you where you heard about them. Please say that FT sent you there to support the show, but also worry about yourself here at rula.com, rula.com/FOUL, and take the first step towards better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares.
And we're back. So Mark, you're up first. Who's a hitter who stands out to you as being, again, doesn't mean he has to be the highest ceiling player, but is a relatively, again, by prospect standards, low risk player to be that because of his hitting ability, especially, but throw the tools in there too.
You led off the show by mentioning I was out on vacation. So I missed the most recent top 100 update. And I was extremely thrilled when I got back to see that JJ Weatherholt was now in the top five, because I think he's a perfect example of a lot of the traits that you guys talked about. Pretty much since the moment he's been drafted, he has raked. He makes great decisions. He makes a ton of contact. And now we've started to see over the last month or so, since he's gotten a AAA especially, that impact is coming. So for me, he especially among these guys at the top, and I would put McGonagall right in the same conversation. I don't have a ton of questions with Weatherholt, or I guess a ton of concerns. I'm more so eager to see him get to the majors pretty soon.
Okay, so Weatherholt's a good one. We'll see if you took Jeff's answer. Not that Jeff doesn't have like five answers. But again, I also like
it was.
But Weatherholt's going to play in the dirt. I figured I actually, that's what I really kind of
never get invited back.
I kind of thought there's no way that Jeff like wasn't going to say Weatherholt, because Weatherholt fits this perfectly too. And he's got AAA experience. He checks every box of this.
Yeah.
But okay. I know though you have one in reserve. So who would you also say fits this?
Yeah, I think, and we already talked about Kevin McGonagall. So I'm going to kind of like throw that one to the side. And I'm going to go with one that I think is probably a little bit of a surprise, because he hasn't been on the top 100 all year long. But Carter Jensen from the Royals, the catching has continued to get better. He's catching well enough to stay at the position for now. And I think, that's something that we hear consistently with catchers that can hit. It buys them opportunities to sort of learn the position. You know, he's got Salvi Perez, who's a player who really improved his defensive skills kind of later in his career as well. So I have a high degree of confidence he's probably going to continue to catch, and he's going to get some opportunities. He's in AAA, he's performing, and the underlying numbers have been really, really good. He's not a 60 or 70 contact guy, like a Weatherholt, or, a McGonagall might be a plus 70 contact guy. He doesn't fall into that range, but it's still above average, rarely misses in zone, doesn't expand the zone all that much. He can be passive at times in zone, but it's not to a fault. It's kind of on that range when you look at some of these percentage numbers that, if he had swung on five or six or seven different pitches that he took over the heart of the plate, all of a sudden, his heart swing rate is kind of in that above average range. But when we look at the power, 106.9 90th percentile exit velocity, a 55.1% hard hit rate. He just consistently makes hard contact all the time. He can put it out to any part of the field, can hit any gap. There's a lot of sort of doubles power in here as well. And does show the ability to pull the ball in the air. Now, he doesn't have an outstanding pull rate, but I think if you've watched his BP like JJ and I did during the Futures game, he had the most impressive round. There's definitely barrel control here. And I think, you know, you've seen a player who has 4 or 5 years of minor league experience now and is really primed for the big leagues. Now, do I think that means, you know, that he's a future 60 or better? Probably not, but I'm pretty comfortable putting him in that 50 to 55 range and that he's going to be an everyday big leaguer and, you know, potentially an above average one at that.
Okay. So I get third pick here. So, okay. Yeah, that's okay. I've still got some here. I will not touch on Samuel Basayo because Basayo does have some risk factors to him. I think that like Samuel Basayo, I would say has the impact, has the chance to be of these top 10 guys, like who like a batting, a home run champ just year after year with exceptional bat, enough bat to ball skills to have surprising batting average, gets on base because people are scared of him. But there is some chase there. The swing decisions, he's 20, but the swing decisions are not exceptional. The bat to ball is good, not exceptional. It's just the power is absolute top tier, barrel rates top tier, all that. I hate to kind of keep with the Tigers, but Max Clark, when we talk about low risk, if you want to quibble about Max Clark, you could quibble and say, I don't know how much impact he's going to have, right? Like the power is good. It's not great right now. Could get there, right? Like it could, but it hasn't gotten there yet. You see, I'll let you chime in there, Jeff.
He hits the ball pretty hard.
Right.
Like I was surprised. Clark's 90th percentile is like 105. The hit tool's super polished. The angles like could get better, but I mean, he shows enough thump that, you know, if he improves his angles and gets to a little bit more pull side power, we could be talking about like 25 home run power. And I don't think we, you know, in scouting reports leading up to the draft, even those that were highest on Clark, it was more like high teen sort of power. He's showing some of the underlying attributes, at least that, you know, if the angles do improve, which I think a player that has his barrel control, who's as young and as athletic and as coachable as Clark is, that might be something that comes along in the coming years, that he might have sneaky 25 home run upside.
Well, the guy I can't help but think about with that, and I'm not saying that he's going to do this, right? But if you would turn back the clock on Pete Crow Armstrong a couple of years, Pete Crow Armstrong in his first full season hit 16. In his second, he hit 20. And then he hit 10 last year, you know, in the big leagues, right? And then this year we see the big power jump. I'm not saying Max Clark has that in him, but I will say, like, it is kind of what, if you have all of these other skills, and by the way, Max Clark's swing decisions are better than Pete Crow Armstrong's.
Much.
Max Clark by far. And this is a center fielder. Like, so I should get away from the impact because really what we're talking about here, the question was lower risk. It's kind of hard to describe how a healthy Max Clark isn't going to be a useful player because he does play up the middle. He does run. He does hit for average. He should draw some walks. He should hit for at least gap power. Like, he could be a very good complementary player to a star. It could be something where you say, and again, this is not saying this is his limit, but you could say he's a 270, 340, 420 hitter who plays a really good center field. That's an excellent player. What's hard to see is how Max Clark, who's now in AA, a healthy Max Clark, because that's always, injuries always are a risk. But it's hard to say that a healthy Max Clark is going to start swinging at everything where he's chasing pitches way out of the zone, or he's not making enough contact, or he's getting the bat blown out of his hands. He just doesn't have any of those attributes. But I will say, okay, the other thing, this is where the Tigers are really good at this. I think Bryce Rainer would have also, other than the injury, been a really good choice for this as well. And if Josue Briseño wasn't a first baseman who probably is not going to catch, he would check these boxes too. The Tigers are doing an exceptional job of acquiring and developing hitters who make good swing decisions, who have bat control and hit the ball hard. And that's where I want, before we moved on from this, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mark, and then I'll come back.
Well, I have two questions to kind of put you on the spot, but tee you up. What do you attribute that to? Like, how much of that is the evaluation of them on amateurs? Like, are they coming in with less risk overall than maybe what you see in other systems versus what they're doing with those players once they get to pro ball? Like, what is so specific to the Tigers that is unlocking what I think you just listed four top 100 prospects who are low risk, safe risk in this conversation?
I would say that they have absolutely emphasized the hit tool in their acquisition, right? Like Max Clark, Bryce Rainer to some extent, and Kevin McGonigal were all, these guys are pure hitters. And then they are doing a good job of helping them develop their power, right? But I'd say that if you're talking about that as a triangle, they have two bases of the triangle when they come in, which is they put bat on ball and they have a good understanding of the strike zone. And if you have those two pieces as your base, adding the impact, the third part of the triangle, is very doable, especially with bat speed training, with, you know, helping guys get into their base, all these things that can kind of go with it. Now, there are other organizations, I think, that emphasize the power component and the, you know, if they have power and they have bat control, then they try to work on swing decision. I think that there are different ways to approach this, but I did want to ask the one thing to Jeff on this, because you thought, like, we have a fun discussion about this. I think of it as a triangle kind of that we're talking about with hitters. And I think you think of it more as four quadrants, because you talk about angles a lot more than I do. And not that I don't think that, obviously, Sal Stewart, to me, being a perfect example of this. Sal Stewart is a guy who, Reds top 100 prospect, third baseman in AAA now. Sal Stewart, until this year, until midway through this year, I would say, fit the description of a player who had good bat-to-ball skills, who hit the ball hard, who made pretty good swing decisions. But if you say, well, why is it not showing up as much in the stat line as you would expect? It would 100% be, as Jeff calls it, the angles. It would be because if you're hitting the ball, if you're never pulling the ball in the air, it's hard to get to a lot of power. Because not that if you have Junior Caminero's oppo power, wonderful for you, but most guys don't.
Yeah, I even think hitting the ball in the air oppo hard, like, you know, hard hit launch angle doesn't discriminate between what field that it's hit to. You know, you could backside those balls and, you know, hit it at 18 degrees and it leaves the park. I mean, there are guys like James Wood in particular, his best batted ball angles were kind of like oppo. So it's okay to kind of do that and play to different parts of the park. It's just a matter of hitting the ball hard in the air. And like that secret sauce, I think, kind of makes a lot of things work. You got to be able to hit the ball and you got to swing at the right pitches to sort of get to that. So yeah, I don't know if I necessarily look at it like that as much as it's all sort of like one sort of graph that's built on four different things. And like, it has to reach a certain point to be successful. And, you know, there's all these different components kind of filling up the cylinder, you know. And now, it's like a mixed drink, you know. You might want the alcohol a little stronger or the mix a little stronger or whatever, or more ice, but altogether it has to taste kind of good, right? And there's different ways to maybe to get to that good taste. It's sort of like there's these different ingredients that come in and they got to sort of work together to sort of make something. You know, whether that's a Shirley Temple or I don't know. I don't know.
0% for the Shirley Temple or the, you know, the Everclear for the, I'm just going, you know, with nothing else.
That's not legal in my state, JJ.
Oh, okay. Did not know that.
No.
But so along those lines, that flips it to the other side of this. Because again, I should say about the angles and all. When we talk about ball flight, I would say that to me, that's kind of the cherry on top. Like if you have these other three things, you're probably going to have, unless your swing is really grooved, you're probably going to develop to the ability where they can unlock that down the road. I kind of look at that as like, again, we're not disagreeing on this, like with what Jeff's saying, like if these are all the ingredients, but I would say that that's kind of like the grad level class, right? Like if you don't have swing decisions where you understand what the strike zone is and you can't control the barrel, you know, you swing over the pitch, you swing under the pitch. If you don't have those things, I don't care. Like if you can get the ball in the air, cause it's like that, then you're going to be okay. Now you're a slugger who, you know, who hits 30 homers, but hits 180 with a, you know, 40% strikeout rate. And that's not going to work. But if you have these other things, if again, with Justin Crawford, for instance, Justin Crawford is going to have survival skills, at least at the big league level, because you could say that you could argue that he doesn't have the impact as much, but when it comes to the bat to ball and all that, he has those things. He's fast, all these. He's up potentially like impact, well, enough impact defensively, but he's going to have to add that grad level part at some point, which is, hey, you know, you have to hit the ball in the air hard at times for it to matter. And hitting the ball on the hard on the ground, just that's singles. Those aren't doubles. Those aren't triples. Those aren't homers unless we're not playing on turf from the 80s, where if you get it past the shortstop, it'll run all the way to the wall. But that leads to the flip side of this, which is, I love how you put it, where the ingredients, like you're mixing the drink or you're making the meal or whatever. We also have guys who 100%, I would say, fit the, hey, they have this, but they don't have this. And when we're talking about risk for hitters, I would say that that kind of is where risk comes into it a lot more, right? If you have a significant issue with one of these components, right, where you don't control the bat, so you struggle to make contact in the zone, or you swing at everything, or you can't hit the ball hard at all, it gets a lot tougher. And we're going to get to that right after this quick break. When your business has an opening that you needed to fill yesterday, there's an easy answer to your problem. How do you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your posts jump to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. For us, Indeed has made hiring easy time after time. We get great candidates who find us on Indeed, and we can do the entire hiring process all within Indeed. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed, and listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? I just took the True Age test from True Diagnostic, and I will soon discover my biological age. Biological age is a powerful indicator of how fast you're aging internally, which directly predicts your risk for serious diseases. Here's why that matters. Research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means you have a lot of control over it. This morning, I took the True Age test. It was easy. I answered a few questions on my phone, watched a video that showed me how to perform the test, pricked my finger. I didn't even feel the prick, to be honest. Provided a sample, then dropped the sample in a mailbox. It's a prepaid envelope, so I didn't even need to go to the post office. In about 2 to 3 weeks, I'll get a detailed online report about my aging and health, fast and hassle-free. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use our code BA2022 to get 20% off of your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use BA2022 at checkout to get 20% off your order. Your future self will thank you. So, Jeff, when we talk about guys who are riskier, even among top 100 prospects, is there one of these components that if you don't, if there's a real issue with it, you look at that as being more worrisome than some of these others?
Yeah, I think it's power. You know, if that is at such a low level that it's tough to even, you know, anticipate that we're going to see doubles, right? I think that's always a concern. And until it gets fixed, it's also very much a limiting factor in the big leagues. I think Victor Robles, who's in the news for other reasons recently, but I think like his sort of struggles with Washington and then resurgence last year is kind of the perfect example of like, he's never going to have huge power. But his lack of power in Washington, especially after his first couple of years, really was kind of dragging down the profile to the point that he got DFA'd and released. Once he gets to Seattle, it's sort of the makeover of adding that additional power, getting some of that thump back. And, you know, ultimately that served him to have a really good season in 2024 and you know, unfortunately dealt with the shoulder issue this year. But I think that's a big one. And then I think the other one is common when we talk about power hitters, and everybody has an example of this going back 30, 40 years, is guys with huge power that don't make enough contact. You know, if you don't have power and you don't make contact, we're probably not talking about you. So I don't think that's ever something we have to deal with. But even more so than swing decisions, because I think some of that stuff can be improved, I think the bat to ball ability is always the one that, you know, can really limit a player where, you know, I think it's been the big question with Spencer Jones. We've seen the sort of contact quality. I mean, there's others that are more extreme examples of this, you know, like George Walkow, right, is kind of a great example of this. Is there enough contact there for him ever to be able to get to it consistently? And, you know, I mean, there's different versions of that player in the minors. There's versions of that guy that it worked until he got to the majors, like a William O'Pena or somebody like that. And it's the guy that can hit the ball 500 feet and hit the most like breathtaking home run you've ever seen in your life. But also, you know, we'll miss against the challenge machine in BP.
I'm going to give you Spencer Jones as your riskiest guy, unless you want a different one, because you brought him up. But the thing with Spencer Jones that does jump out is if he does succeed in the big leagues, I would say that one of two things will have to happen. One, his bat to ball, his bat control, his ability to hit the ball in the strike zone, because major league pitchers can challenge you in the zone. It'll have to get, I would say, two grades better, or he would have to be the greatest outlier that we're seeing in the big leagues. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I would agree with that. I think that for this to work, he's going to have to be the outlier of outliers. It's, you know, it's Joey Gallo. I mean, that, and we saw how that never really fully gelled. Like there were periods
there were some years
where he was pretty good, but I think
40 homers.
If we go down and we kind of break down those years, there's also stretches within those seasons where like, if you are a fan of the team that Joey Gallo is playing for, the Rangers, whatever, there were stretches where you were like, this is an automatic out. And I think you see that with players like that at every level. It could be Little League. It could be the Cape. It could be college. It could be the minors, where it's like, this guy is stuck in between right now. And he's either scared to swing, and when he does, he's probably going to miss it. And it is a profile that we see a lot of nowadays, because those guys, you know, jump out in athletic testing, the EVs get teams to sign them, and there's upside. I mean, it's a worthy risk and it's a worthy gamble for teams. But I think we've seen a lot of these guys, and we haven't necessarily seen a lot of them click playing that style of baseball and hitting that way without some sort of major overhaul in terms of the swing decisions, bat path, or bat to ball skills, which sometimes they all kind of work together.
Mark, like you do the Pirates for us. I would say that the bargain basement version of this is a guy that I remember you and I talking about for the, do we keep him on the top 30 last year, which is Tony Blanco Jr.
Yes.
who, by the way, Tony Blanco Jr. hits the ball harder than Spencer Jones. Like, if you said
he might hit it harder than Judge.
If you said, I was going to say, if you said, give me the best raw power in professional baseball, I would say a healthy Stanton, probably, you know, maybe he's at the very end of this now, but for the longest time it was Stanton. I would say now it's O'Neill Cruz. O'Neill Cruz, who is a Pirate also, I would say I witnessed it in person. Like I always said, Joey Gallo would always be my North Star as far as just raw power. And then I was in Atlanta for the Home Run Derby and O'Neill Cruz hit a ball that I'm like, that left the stadium. And I don't know how that's possible that he did that, which I think was like 122 mile an hour EV or something like that. And it was just like my head exploded. But that's Tony Blanco Jr. That's like, we're talking 118, 119 in the FSL. I mean, where a league where you can see games where no one hits a ball over 105, right? Like he's at 3 to 4 standard deviations above most FSL players. But there's a little of an asterisk here. We're talking about him. Like we were debating whether you keep him in the 30, not in the top 100, but in the 30, because that's the carrying tool for him. And he doesn't have the bat to ball and the swing decisions to go with it, at least yet. Right.
Yeah. Well, Blanco's so tantalizing. He missed the first half of this year. He fell off the Pirates list. He came back, and I think within his first week, he hit a ball 119. And it took literally a week of games for me to be like, you know, I might need to get this guy back on my 30. Like, how do you let something like that stray so far away? I mean, with Spencer Jones too, like he demonstrates value in other areas where Blanco, I think it's straight DH. Like, maybe he plays first base. Like the path for him is just so fraught from here to the majors, but sure. Like that is like the outlier of outlier that keeps you intrigued.
I would say with that, and I'm going to tee you up then, Mark, for your, who's the riskiest guy, but I just want to add one more thing with Spencer Jones to Jeff's point with Joey Gallo, but it kind of is true with Spencer Jones. Spencer Jones in AAA, we just said he just had one of the all time heaters where he had a stretch there where it was like they were throwing, you know, beach balls to the plate and he was exploding them pitch after pitch. But that said, even with that, like if we just look at his AAA numbers, not his AA numbers, just AAA, where again, he just had one of the great stretches you'll ever see a professional hitter have. It's a 31%, according to Synergy Sports, a 31% swing and miss rate in the zone. And a 34% swing and miss rate on fastballs in the zone. That is a rate that is extremely high, period. And to be doing that while you are still also having, like, you know, the way I would put it is that he has 88 plate appearances over that time, you know, and on in-zone pitches, right? He has 279 in-zone pitches. He's hit 11 homers on in-zone pitches because he's hit some on the out-of-zone pitches too. But he's also swung and missed 68 times in the zone on that. When we're talking about like just from a pure, yes, you only need one pitch out of three before you strike out that you put in contact and drive. But you're putting so much pressure on everything else because you are going to take strikes sometimes. Sometimes you're going to wisely take strikes where you go, that's not a pitch I can do anything with. It's not two strikes. I'm letting that one go. That's where there are these concerns. So I wanted to add that a little bit there too. But along those lines, Mark, who is your riskiest hitter that jumps out to you in the top?
So I took this in a little bit of a different direction, I think, than you two did. I was thinking about risk relative to expectation or risk relative to your position on the board. And I kept coming back to Jordan Lawler. To keep Jeff's ingredients analogy going, I think this is a great example of the ingredients getting close to feeling stale. And you guys have had a lot of good conversations earlier in the year about the Orioles. And like you reach this like inflection point as an organization of when you have to make decisions on guys, whether, you know, they need major league time. Do you need to trade them? I think with Lawler, we're approaching that point, and I'm still a little concerned with what I'm seeing about him meeting the expectations that might accompany a guy who's been floating around the back of the top 10 of our list for most of the year, especially when you think about what the Diamondbacks might need him to be. And I think that's a third baseman in the long run. I don't think Geraldo Perdomo is a 5-win player this year in F4. Like, I don't think Lawler's moving him off of shortstop. So
not now.
Yeah, not now, right? And I mean, there's an availability piece with Lawler as well. I think he's around like 400 or so at bats over three AAA seasons. You know, he doesn't play a ton. His brief cup of coffee has not gone well in the majors. And then you start to peel back some of the underlying data, and the 90th percentile EVs are okay. I think they're 104. The swing decisions are solid. Like, it's all pretty good. But if this is your third baseman of the future, I'd like to see him on the field. And I have some questions about both the impact and how, like, the adjustability on defense to move around, whether it's third base, second base, et cetera. This is a guy for someone who has been near the top of our top 100 for so long. I think you're arriving at a point where you either need to see it regularly, be on the field and show that impact. I think he's ready for an extended look in the majors. And then as you kick it forward into the offseason, like, I think there are still reasonably significant questions on whether, like, you feel comfortable trusting Lawler every day next year for a team that I think has pretty big aspirations of turning things around quickly. So for me, relative to where he is on our board, Jordan Lawler, there's a lot more risk than I think you might expect, given his pedigree and how long he's kind of been in this position.
I'm going to go in a little different direction. A little guy a little further down on the top 100, but also one has been notable in the headlines recently. And this is the perfect example to me of, like, when we say there's risk here, do understand this. We're not saying these guys are doomed or anything, because one of my adages that I've kind of become annoyingly repeating a lot in discussions lately and on the conversations I have is, it's like, the game has to teach you. And until you hit that point as a prospect where you struggle, it's really hard to change things that are working for you. You know, again, just Justin Crawford's example, I use a lot for that because he's hitting 300 in AAA. And you can say you need to change your swing, you need to change your setup, you know, all these things, because it's not going to work for him in the big leagues, but it's never not worked for him. You know, Yadier Arenado, who just was traded to the Rays from the Brewers, I know he needs to chase less, but at the same time, it's hard to learn to chase less when you won a batting title in the first league you were in 2 years ago in full season ball, and you finished second in batting in the next league you were in. Those kind of things, it's harder to do those, harder to teach those. Eduardo Tait, who was a Phillies prospect just traded to the Twins in the Yoan Duran trade. Tait has exceptional, when we talk about the ability to impact the baseball, he hits the ball really hard, especially for a player his age. He has good bat-to-ball skills as well, back and barrel control. He can hit. He can drive the ball on pitches that maybe sometimes aren't the best pitches to drive. So he's got, when we talk about, you know, I talk about the triangle here that I think of it as, he's got two of those components. He chases outside of the zone at a frightening rate. And if you're watching us on YouTube, though, I'll have a little graphic here that just shows all the pitches that he swung at outside of the zone this year. The thing that stands out with that, though, is when I say that the game has to teach you the lesson, in A-ball, so far, it hasn't taught him a lesson. He has kind of the bat-to-ball skills. Hector Rodriguez, to use another guy who came up through the FSL in the Red system, was another one of these guys who was extremely aggressive. But Hector Rodriguez didn't get taught in A-ball to ever take a pitch, because he hit 300 while hitting all those pitches and driving them. I remember writing a couple of years ago about Christian Encarnacion Strand and how good of a bad ball hitter he was in AAA. Well, the game taught him the lesson. He got to the majors, and all of a sudden, that didn't work for him anymore, and he's going to have to figure that out. And by the way, if he doesn't, he won't have a productive big league career. But again, that doesn't mean Tait can't have a big productive big league career. It's just that he is extremely aggressive, which does lead to questions about, will that be something that trips him up as he faces more advanced pitching? We'll see. That's an interesting question to see. That was a fun discussion. We got another one, though, that we want to get to, which is as we said, Mark does the Pirates for us. He's been doing the Pirates list for us, you know, for a couple of years here. Several years, actually, if I say on and off, you know, over the years. But Mark, I want to kind of ask with that. So with Bubba Chandler, we've talked a lot about Bubba, and Bubba has been very interesting this year. Bubba Chandler has some of the best velocity that you're going to see among a starting pitcher in minor league baseball. Not the best. Harlan Suzanne is like, excuse me, guys, I'm over here, and there's 102 whenever I just reach back and want it. But you can see, you know, 101, 102, even if you at times from Bubba. He's been in AAA all year. He is now, I would say, one of the more seasoned AAA pitchers for a pitching prospect that we've seen in quite a while. They found as far as the amount of innings that he's thrown in AAA, but they have been a little rocky at times this year. What are you seeing? Like, as someone who's kind of really dug deep into this, what are you seeing from Bubba? What is he doing better? What is he struggling to do as well as he did in the past? And what do you think kind of it adds up to in the big picture?
Yeah, I think you're a professional. It's a professional transition. I think that in some instances for Bubba, the game is teaching him a little bit this year in terms of what you can and cannot get away with. And he really hasn't dealt with too much adversity in his pro career prior to the last 2 months. I think you asked, what's he doing well or even better than last year? Everything that we loved about Bubba Chandler last year, the offseason, when he was up in the top five of our top 100, metrically is still intact. He's actually throwing a little bit harder this year than he was last year. The ingredients with the unicorn fastball, in terms of the carry through the zone and the velocity, like you mentioned, it's all still there. His biggest issue from everything that I've been able to pick up on is simply striking it at a level that he did last year. He's not throwing his fastball. It sounds very simple and reductive in some ways, but he's not throwing his fastball for strikes enough. There's a lot of times when you watch Chandler starts, especially recently, and you mentioned Spencer Jones earlier. He just faced him on Saturday, three really good at-bats. He's fallen behind in those at-bats pretty frequently. I think his strike percentage and synergy, which we use as a tool, is down from 67% last year to 63% this year. His overall strike percentage for the season is 62%. And even when he was on fire back in April and May, his command was inconsistent at best. I think he was getting away with a little bit because the stuff is so good. I think for him, everything kind of predicates off of that fastball. And more frequently, he's lost that fastball up. He's lost that fastball up into the arm side. I think the AAA zone is a little bit tighter than what he's pitched at previous to last year as well. That's the biggest concern for me, is just the how in and out he's been this year in terms of being able to command it. There's a secondary concern in that I don't feel like the off-speed, the breaking ball has taken the step maybe that we hope to see. I think the slider is still average to solid average. He's experimented with the curveball this year. In the last couple starts, it really hasn't been too much of his mix. It's really fastball and his changeup's taken a step forward. But I think those are the two big pieces. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion about how the Pirates have handled when it was time to call him up or not. I think that there's part of that too. But for me, it really all just comes back to the fastball command has not been as sharp as it was a year ago.
So how much of that, I have to ask the question, how much of that do you think is AAA? Because we've talked about AAA has a smaller strike zone now, like than the majors, because of the ABS zone, because of how it is designed, and because of the challenge system. It's not 100% that, but it's 95% that it is the smallest zone. We see a lower strike percentage in AAA than we see in the majors. We see a lower percentage of called strikes on the edges of the zone in AAA than we see in the majors. Is this something that is an issue for him, do you think, long-term? Or is it potential that this is, hey, the fastball percentage will go, strike percentage will go back up when he hits the majors, and maybe this is a blip because AAA is so challenging?
I wouldn't call it a blip. I think that he's someone who needs to live near the top of the zone or enjoys living near the top of the zone because of how the fastball plays. There are a lot of times where the miss is fairly non-competitive at the top of the zone. I think that the AAA zone might be a part of it. I think he's such a dynamic mover. He's such a good athlete. he pitches with such arm speed that I think when things get a little sideways on him mechanically, we've always thought for such a long time, he's such a good athlete that the strikes will come, the strikes will get better. I still believe that. I think that he will be a average strike thrower in time, but I think that, sinking it back up this year, once it especially in June and July, when things started to go a little sideways, has taken him longer. And I think that's, if anything, a concern for me, like the amount of time it's taken for him to kind of sink back up and regain some of the fastball command, that's been more eye-opening for me.
So to just put a kind of a little bit of a bow on this, if we're talking about, like, it feels like that Bubba Chandler's impact in the majors has been a little slowed this year by these struggles. If we're looking at 26, do you still feel pretty comfortable about his ability to succeed the major league level? Or you think it's more like, hey, this may be a little bit longer of an acclimation period. We're talking more like 27 before he kind of really settles in? Or what do you see? What do you think this means for kind of the long term for him?
No, I'm still on the 26 ETA. I think it becomes a significant question that we have to dive into if we don't see him in the majors before the end of the year. I think that's when it really starts to become the red flag, or the red lights are blaring. I mean, when you talk to people in the Pirates system about Chandler, like elite athletes are competitive, but they talk about his competitiveness in a way that you don't normally hear. Most prospects, or at least players that I've covered, I think that when he didn't get called up in May, when he was pretty much on par with Jacob Mizorowski, and you saw Mizorowski get called up, you saw Chase Burns get called up, these are two guys in the division. I think that when that didn't happen, and he's actually, I believe on the record, talked about some of the frustration of still being in the minor leagues. Like, I think that was something that he worked through and maybe was part of the struggles. I think that's part of it. But then when you also fall out of whack with your mechanics and it takes some time to get back into that, that's the piece of it, which I think is a little bit more troubling. But, this is just speculation. I don't have this reported, but I would think, especially based off of the opening in the rotation that they have right now and where the Pirates are this season, we're past the August 15th date. That is very important for them, that we see Chandler before the end of the season.
I'll just kind of throw this to you for a second too, Jeff. Like, if we don't see Bubba this year, other than he's hurt or something, which he's not right now, it kind of a shocking development. I'll kind of leave it at that, because I do want us to also get to our prospect soapboxes, and we've already been going almost an hour here. So, Jeff, to kind of kick it off with you, who is your, as we always say, our prospect soapboxes have to be talking about a guy who's not in the top 100, but someone who intrigues you for some reason. So, Jeff, who is your prospect soapbox?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm going back in on a player that, you know, having done the Cardinals list for 3 years here now, I more or less thought this player was sort of left for dead. I think he snuck onto the back end of the handbook list last year based on internal feedback. Talking about outfielder Josh Baez. Baez has had a true sea change sort of season in terms of his plate skills. Going back the last 3 years, you know, this was a guy, kind of going back to an earlier conversation that we had, where the contact just quite frankly was not at the level that it needed to be to get to the impact and all the supporting tools that Baez had. You know, he's got an arm, he can run, he's a good outfielder, was a two-way player in high school. And there were some people who liked him as a pitcher because he was up to, you know, mid-90s in the mound. So there's a lot of those ingredients here, but the contact was just a non-starter. 2023 season miss rate, 43.2%, zone miss rate, 37%. Those are 20 grade contact numbers. 2024, we go to the contact numbers. It gets a little bit better, but still not there at all. 37.4% miss rate, 28.1% zone miss. And mind you, this whole time, the chase rates in each of these three seasons I'll mention were between 27 and 29%. So like rounding errors type sort of thing. So it wasn't a matter of expanding the zone so much for him. The underlying power numbers, the 90th percentile EV has been between 105 and 107 in all three of these seasons. what really changed was 2025, he's now an above average contact hitter. Well, for the most part. So the zone contact rate is now at 20.6%. That is very acceptable. And I think especially when you consider a majority of his season has come at the double A level. 27.5% overall miss rate. That bests his best zone miss rate of his career. 22.1% chase rate. So those numbers have gotten better this year. The swing rate is 46%. I believe it was 47% 2 years ago. And then last year was 51%. So the approach as well as the bat to ball skills have really rounded into form. And he's hitting for the best power of his career, 107.2 90th percentile EV, 47% hard hit rate, low ground ball rate, puts the ball in the air quite a bit. You know, I think sort of the only question at this point when, you know, we look at, you know, his data is just sort of, is this going to scale into AAA and then the majors? Overall, I think it will. He's made really good swing decisions. Like we said, the chase rate's really low. The hard swing rate is 78.5%, which is well above average. So it's true above average to maybe even plus approach. It's probably plus power with really good angles. His average hard hit launch angle, so that's any ball in play above 95 degrees, is 95 miles per hour, is 18 degrees. That's an outstanding number as well. So I think when you look at ball flight, when you look at angles, when you look at bat to ball skills now, when you look at approach, he's checking all those boxes. Plus he's got that arm. He's got that running ability. I believe there's a chance that he has a 2040 season this year. He needs six more home runs, 2050 season, six more home runs to get to 20 and four more steals to get to 50. So when I look at a player like this, I'm going to have some more conversations in the offseason. He's another guy that could push up into the top five, maybe for the Cardinals. And this might be a top 100 prospect just based on all these skills. And this has been a real change, the type of change we don't typically see in terms of swing and miss. And that's not something you can typically fake.
That, you know, he's an interesting one. My soapbox today, I'm going to the Marlins. Luis Cova, outfielder for the Marlins. This is where this gets a little tricky, right? He is a second-year DSL guy. That is something that is a lot more common now than it used to be and is not nearly the scarlet letter that it used to be because understandably now where you have fewer complex spots when you bring a guy over, he counts immediately towards your running 165, you know, roster limit in the minors. And on top of that, you would rather, like, we're still talking about an 18-year-old. So, okay, like, he's going to be coming over next year as a still 18-year-old, turn 19 in that season, probably will reach A-ball next year. So, it feels like that's caveat. But I'm highlighting him because the feedback we have gotten on him from the DSL this year is very strong. 299, 422, 537 with almost as many walks as strikeouts. We've seen power. He's got 9 homers this year. He has 35 steals. We've also got feedback that when it comes to swing decisions, when it comes to ability to drive the ball, when it comes to bat to ball skills, all these things are also looking good. This is the guy who was a prominent signee for them not that long ago. And I would say if, like, you look at our most recent, Jacob Rutner did our Marlins top 30. He's kind of consistently been moved. Cova's been moving up that list. I would say he's not sniffing the top 100 or anything like that, but that's why we bring him up on a prospect soapbox. This is the guy who could get there down the road. Not there yet, but keep an eye on him. And again, we try to give you some names here. This is what we love to do. Like, we have these discussions all the time. And so we try to turn some of them into podcasts and videos and all for you all, you know, like, again, like, this is like when we talked about Tony Blanco Jr., that is someone that Mark and I spent a lot of time talking about, I feel like, last year. But along those lines, Mark, you don't have to have a soapbox. You're our guest here on the Prospect podcast today, but we don't want to take you, you know, take away the chance if you had someone that you wanted to talk about.
Well, you don't want to show up as a guest and then say something dumb. So I feel better that you also just went with a second-year DSL guy, because I also do the A's 30 for us. And one guy who has popped up a little bit in reporting, and also the data has definitely piqued our interest, is Edgar Montero. Right now, he's kind of in the 20th range on their list. I could see him moving up a little bit more. Second year in the DSL, there were concerns last year. He's a switch hitter, about how the swing would kind of grow up on both sides of the ball. He also needed to get in better shape. He answered a lot of questions, I think, that the A's had from him last year, went back to the DSL. He's been crushing this year. I think his 90th EV is closing in on 105 right now at 18 years old. The angles are pretty good. He'll need to swing a little bit more. I think he's, frankly, a little bit too advanced for some of the pitching he's seeing right now. So, again, this isn't a guy who's going to be in the top five of the A's 30 in a couple months. He's not a top 100 prospect. But in a system that has graduated a lot, and we're starting to look for the next wave of interesting guys in the A system, Edgar Montero is someone that has my attention as we go into handbook reporting season.
That's a good one to kind of to end this with. So this is another Baseball America Prospect podcast. We do this every week, and we love to kind of talk about prospects to hopefully give you some sneak peeks, some insight, not just on the top prospects in the game, but also on players who are a little less on the radar. That's what we kind of end it with, soapbox. This was a fun discussion today. We will continue it again next week with another Prospect Podcast. Please like and subscribe if you, whether it's through your podcast feed or whether it's through YouTube. And if you have comments, please leave them on YouTube. We do try to answer them. We do try to read them. Can't promise we'll 100% get to it, but we do generally try to get to it. For Mark, for Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.